Hello, and this is Tim Reedy. Welcome to the American Magazine podcast, and we're happy to be joined by Father Jim Martin, who's going to be talking with me about the end of the second season of Downton Abbey. Welcome, Father Jim.
Great to be here to talk about our favorite show.
Yes, we've done this once before with Mad Men, where we did kind of a post-season wrap-up, and we couldn't resist the urge to do it with our favorite show of 2012 so far.
And we also do it on Monday mornings.
Right, exactly. So you get to listen in. Perhaps, Father Jim, you could begin by introducing Julian Fellowes, who is the creator of this show.
Yeah, we just read an interesting article in the Tablet, the London Tablet, which is the great Catholic newspaper over there, magazine. And it turns out that he had gone to Ampleforth, which is the very prestigious Benedictine school, and credited one of the Benedictine monks over there for encouraging him to take his theatrical interests into a career. He's also apparently very active in the Catholic world. He runs, I think, he's director of the Catholic Academy of Performing Arts. So we were thinking of talking about Downton Abbey from a Catholic point of view and trying to uncover or reveal some of the Catholic themes, or at least some of the Christian themes that I don't think a lot of commentators have really talked about. It's been mostly about class and income and things and anachronisms and things like that. But so Tim and I are going to try to talk about some of the Catholic themes of Downton Abbey.
Right. There's nothing obvious on the surface, at least. I mean, there are no Catholic characters, or at least publicly Catholic characters. But yet there are some themes that we're going to draw out. One is the whole idea of good and evil. And from the very first episode, where you have on one hand kind of the saintly valet returning from war in Bates, Mr. Bates, and then you have O'Brien on the other side, the kind of mean-spirited ladies' maid who trips him up in order to kind of show him for how weak he is. So right there, you've got both those extremes.
Yeah, and you know, she really is kind of wicked. But I think, and you also have Thomas, you know, the sort of the evil
O'Brien's,
the evil footman,
right?
Her henchman.
Henchman, yes.
But interestingly, you know, what happens is as the series moves on, these characters become a little more complex. So even someone like the Dowager Countess, everybody's favorite character, who at the beginning is just kind of waspish and biting, towards the end, you know, she has that great conversation with Daisy about Daisy's self-sacrifice in marrying William, the dying former soldier. You know, she reveals herself to be much more complex. And even O'Brien, you know, moves from evil to, I would say, less evil, if not good, after she has a sort of conversion moment when she realizes how evil she's been. There's that great scene where, which I was actually shocked at. I couldn't believe she did it. The lady of the house, Lady Cora, is pregnant. Everyone's so excited because this is possibly the heir to the great, you know, the house, and will save everybody's fortunes. And O'Brien puts a bar of soap next to the bath so she will slip. And, you know, which really, I mean, talk about pure evil. But then, you know, as the show moves on, she feels a certain regret. And when Lady Cora is ill, she tries to make some sort of confession. So there's this move from evil to good for at least some of the characters, or at least a greater complexity.
Now, why? I mean, obviously, from a dramatic point of view, the juxtaposition between good and evil is always compelling. But what do you think he's up to here in trying to present people with such kind of stark differences? Is it to dig deeper and show us that not every person is perhaps as good or as evil as they may first appear?
Well, I always think of it in terms of, you know, there being initially only one season for Downton Abbey. It was only supposed to be one season. And it's interesting that, you know, if the season had ended after, you know, season one, you know, you would have still had evil O'Brien and evil Thomas. And maybe he realized that to continue it, you have to have people that are, you know, more complex if it's not going to turn out to be kind of this, you know, sort of pasteboard characters, you know, kind of battling against one another. So perhaps the fact that, you know, he had to have another season meant that he had to have more complexity. I think it certainly makes them more interesting. I mean, O'Brien is fascinating to me. You know, I mean, she seems consumed by some sort of resentment. But she's, you know, very tearful, and she's very selfless when it comes to taking care of Cora. Whether or not that's out of guilt or out of a sense of, you know, real conversion, it's difficult. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think they're becoming more complex?
Oh, absolutely. And another thing we wanted to take up is in season two, you have this very interesting subplot involving O'Brien, where it's the Spanish flu. Lady Cora is very sick, and she selflessly nurses her through the night. And near the end, where it seems like Lady Cora might actually be near death, she pleads for her and is about to kind of confess what she did, that act that you said. So it's very moving that, you know, it shows that the need for even some of these characters who may seem not to care actually it's very important to them to seek some kind of forgiveness.
Right. I mean, and it's St. Ignatius's dictum that love shows itself in deeds, not in words. I mean, she's really trying to nurse her and trying to help her. I also think of Lady Mary. I think Lady Mary's character has changed dramatically. I thought her and the middle sister who wrote that terrible letter,
Edith,
about Mr. Pamuk, were pretty unsavory in season one. And, you know, Mary's rejection of Matthew, I thought, was completely opportunistic. You know, basically, I'm only going to accept you if it turns out that, you know, you can give me something, right? But she also deepens. I think there's a sense where she has to forgive herself too. You know, before she sees herself as worthy to even be considered by him again. I think a lot of the characters have to forgive others, have to forgive themselves, and also need to be forgiven. I think that's a really important theme for the show.
Now, you mentioned Matthew and Mary, so we should take up the love story, which is at the center of this whole episode. And that is, I guess, to be expected. A classic period story has this, like Pride and Prejudice, right, has this great love story at the center. But what's interesting is the other types of love that Julian Fellowes is interested in showing. And one is during World War I, when Matthew is injured, Mary attends to him just as devotedly as we were saying O'Brien attended to her to Lady Cora, and you know, with a real sense of love, and even in very difficult circumstances where she has to hold his head while he's getting sick, and a very touching scene where Matthew's mother's returning and she's watching this and says to her, you've become quite the nurse to Mary, and Mary says, well, it's nothing, and she says, no, it's the opposite of nothing, and she doesn't say it, but it's, you're showing how much you really love him.
Yeah, and it's a sign of how much she has changed. I think to me, for some reason, she seemed more devoted to him than Lavinia was.
Lavinia being his fiancée.
Mm-hmm, his doomed fiancée. Poor Lavinia, star-crossed Lavinia.
Yeah, she seems smitten with him, certainly, but not quite as just totally devoted.
It's interesting. There are lots of loves, as you say. There's the sort of traditional love between Lord Grantham and Lady Grantham, which, you know, at the beginning apparently was a kind of marriage of convenience, you would suspect. There's Matthew and Lady Mary. There are all sorts of other romantic relationships like that you were hoping to end in marriage, like Anna and Mr. Bates, things like that. But there's also something like Carson and Lady Mary. I mean, there's a love there. Or Carson and Mrs. Hughes. There's a kind of love and a fondness. There's that beautiful scene where Carson thinks that he's going to work for Lady Mary and Sir Richard, the evil Sir Richard, and there's another bad character. And Mrs. Hughes says, well, you know, I will miss you if you go. So there's fondness there, and there's fondness below stairs. So I think it's an interesting point that there are different kinds of loves, but besides just the romantic love, you know, that is at the center of the show between Mary and Matthew.
And different kinds of family, too. Like, you've got the classic family who live in this house, and who is going to be the next to inherit it is of utmost importance. But then you have these families downstairs of people who often don't have parents or have long since passed away, and their only family is the Crawleys.
We were talking earlier that we don't want to elevate it to something that it's not. There was that great classic memoir that came out, Below Stairs, that talked about how there really was a divide between, as the author said, us and them. It was written by a woman in service at one of these great manor houses. And sometimes when I'm watching the show, I wonder if we're not being, fed something that seems good for us but may not be really that accurate. So this idea of there being this great love between the upstairs and the downstairs, makes for good drama, but how realistic is it? I wonder if we would feel the same way if it were about slavery, in pre-Civil War America, if we would say, oh, isn't that wonderful that they're all getting along so well? So, I think of the novel Brideshead Revisited, where one of Evelyn Waugh's characters, the Oxford aesthete Anthony Blanche, warns the protagonist, Charles Ryder, against, quote, that creamy English charm. It kills everything it touches and somehow blinds our critical faculties. And, as much as I celebrate these loves and these romances, I have to sometimes check myself and say, is this really plausible? Would Carson really be that open with Lady Mary? Would he be, at the end of season two, hugging her, publicly? Maybe he would. I don't know much about English country houses. But, from what I read about the reality of it, maybe that's a little far-fetched.
Now, yes, there are some in Britain who have been very critical of the show, who feel like they glorified this kind of rarefied class system. People who actually lived through this and said, it's not all that it's cracked up to be. Mm-hmm. One of which is Simon Schama, the historian, and I'll read you one quote from him here. It says, It's a servile soap opera that an American public desperate for something, anything, to take its mind off the perplexities of the present seems only too happy to down in great, grateful gulps.
I wonder what the Dowager Countess would say about that.
So we might be guilty of that, but I'm trying to find some redeeming things here about the show. So some other themes that I think, one is grace and the workings of grace. Perhaps we can address in the character of Daisy and her relationship with William.
Well, that's a very interesting relationship and very complex. I think most people who are listening to this know the relationship, but for the three who don't, Daisy is encouraged by Mrs. Patmore, the cook downstairs, to marry William before he goes off to war. And it's a kind of conflict between two goods, because Mrs. Patmore obviously wants the best for William. She wants to give him a sweetheart to kind of pine for and to give him something to live for.
Well, at least they were going to become sweethearts before the war. And then the marriage came later, I think.
And Daisy feels funny about that, because I don't think she's completely sold on William. But in the end, when he comes back wounded and is about to die, she marries him. And I think Mrs. Patmore really is trying to encourage that. And most people think she's being very selfless, including William's father, but she doesn't, right? I mean, she feels pretty conflicted.
Well, it's interesting. Daisy is the lowest person on the, upstairs, downstairs, but the Downton Abbey chain. You know, she's not allowed upstairs, and she's at Mrs. Padmore's beck and call, yet she has a great deal of integrity, so much so that she doesn't want to... What she thinks is a lie, the fact that she really did not love William enough to marry him. She doesn't want to kind of go along with this. And he's even almost willing to say something to William's father. But I think it almost pushes her to kind of learn something about herself as she starts to kind of say, well, maybe I did really love him.
Well, there's that great moment of grace, which brings us to what we were talking about just recently, with the Dowager Countess, which something of a far-fetched scene where Daisy is standing upstairs in the drawing room, and she's being talked to and given advice by the Dowager Countess, who says, you must have loved him if you did something that wonderful for him. And it was a form of love, which I think, allows her in a sense to forgive herself and to move on a little bit. And it also shows that, that the Countess knows a little bit more about life than, we would think from her kind of zippy asides. Sometimes I think she's just like Oscar Wilde in drag, which is probably redundant. But I find her character fascinating. I felt guilty at the beginning. I wrote this for a piece on the web that the show was, Simon Shaman was saying, celebrates incoming inequalities, celebrates a kind of noblesse oblige. Isn't it wonderful that Lord Grantham actually went to the pub to talk to Bates as if they were equals? And also the character of the Dowager Countess bothered me a little bit because, she was basically mocking people. A lot of the things that were repeated on the web were kind of put downs, of other people. But, she has revealed herself, or Julian Fellowes has revealed herself, to be a lot more complex. As I think also it's a tribute to Maggie Smith's wonderful acting skills.
Yes, when the war comes and, the hard decisions have to be made, she's often on the right side. No, she's the one who brings William to the house and said, let him die here, even when there's resistance, because no, we can't interfere with the workings of the, he's not an officer. He doesn't deserve to be here. She says, enough with that. I'll call in some chips and get him here. So she, when it gets down to it, she's willing to kind of do the right thing.
Which is ironic, because she was the one that was always kind of battling to keep things the way that they were. She doesn't like any newfangled things entering into it.
Of course, like electricity.
Right. Which would give her the vapors. I also like that she called, was it Shrimpy, her friend?
That's the scene I'm referring to, where she calls in his favor. That was hilarious.
Only in the English upper classes. When she said that, it reminded me of P.G. Woodhouse, Bertie Wooster and all of his, the Drones Club and Gussie Fink Noddle and all these crazy nicknames that they have.
You got to think Julian Fellowes is maybe nodding in that direction with a name like that. But it's probably also true to the English upper classes that they had those kind of those names for each other.
Yeah, one of the ones I like in Jeeves and Wooster is Barmy Fungy Phipps. That's one of them. Good friend Barmy.
I should note that the musical Zip Goes a Million, which they play a song from, was written by P.G. Woodhouse.
Is that true?
Yes, they mentioned this.
Oh, there's a little bit of a nod.
It was Jerome Kern who did the music, and the text was P.G. Woodhouse.
Zip Goes a Million.
This is when the big kiss between Mary and Matthew in the second season, he's playing this And yeah, as they said on Slate, somebody needs to revive that show stat. Well,
well, now there's something. I do think that people, there's a, we talk about suffering might be our next theme.
Sure. Yeah.
But people are often punished, you know, very severely for what they do. I mean, there's this scene where Lady Mary and Matthew kiss. They have a stolen kiss, and you know, while his fiance is dying upstairs, and of course the fiance comes down very wan with a shawl around her, and we have, we know that we're given to believe that she has coughing, that she has seen the kiss, and of course she dies, and you know, Matthew says that she died from a broken heart, and I saw one commentator also on Slate that said, no, you know, she died of Spanish flu, Matthew. But you know, he's really punished. I mean, he's down in the dumps, and you know, it seems like the marriage is off, but. But these kind of small peccadilloes, you know, for example, Mr. Bates saying, you know, basically, I wish my wife were dead, you know, I mean, lands him, you know, almost in the hangman's noose. So there is a sort of, there's a bit of drama in terms of how much people have to suffer for their ills. Although I'm wondering when Thomas is going to get his comeuppance.
Yes, every time you think, like in season two, like he starts to go into the black market, and he does get, you know, somebody swindles him, and it's just like you feel, you know, sort of like, well, finally he got what it was coming to him. But he's slowly kind of climbing the ranks back, and he's going to be the Lord's valet.
Yeah, he's a snake,
season.
But I think Lord Grantham will see through him somehow, or Carson will.
Yes.
You know. The other thing that was surprising to me was Branson. We haven't talked about that relationship
with
him and
Lady
his
Sybil.
Lady Sybil. You know, he basically is going to throw a cow pat and ink on one of the visiting dignitaries, the visiting general, and he's forgiven pretty easily. I was kind of surprised by that. They kind of let him off pretty well.
Yes, no, they did. It's true. It's true. And if that had happened, perhaps there would be no grandchild from Dublin, as appears to be the
case. There's the Catholic theme coming exactly. in, so we're waiting for Lord Grantham's Catholic baptism grandchild.
We should mention that Julian Fellowes has said that there will be some kind of Catholic theme in the third season, so that should make for some interesting watching.
That
so.
And Shirley MacLaine coming in as Cora's Araviste mother, no doubt.
Well, that should be fun to watch. And you did mention Bates. Maybe we should talk about him more as a character. Somebody who, as somebody I think, again on Slate, said he wears his top coat like a crown of thorns. Because he always is kind of always burdened by something.
And he really looks happy even when he's with Anna. He looks so mopey all the time.
Yeah.
But no, that's that same theme of suffering. I mean, he's really sort of the long-suffering person. And is trying to do the right thing. I mean, he stayed away from the house for months, I assume. It's very hard to tell in terms of Downton Abbey. People come and go. But he refused to divulge the reason that he had left.
His wife came back and was essentially blackmailing him.
Yeah, and there's another sort of character of evil, like pure evil. So it's very interesting to see the way different people suffer. I think also the way Mrs. Patmore suffered when her nephew was found to be a deserter and shot was very interesting. And the other part of the suffering that I like in terms of the way it's presented is the way people respond. I think Lord Grantham sending Mrs. Patmore to an eye hospital, I thought was very compassionate. There are these kind of intrusions of compassion and forgiveness and grace in the midst of suffering that kind of cut, you know, the divide between upstairs and downstairs, which I think is kind of moving. Once again, I don't know how realistic it is, but it's moving on the show.
And you still get the feeling that suffering, I mean, you always feel that it's going to head back in that direction. Like with Anna and Bates, they got married and then, you know, they had a nice honeymoon night and then he's arrested.
Star-crossed. Yeah, one of our reviewer, John Anderson, was reviewing it in the culture section. He calls it the snake-bitten romance, I think. The other relationship in terms of forgiveness and suffering that I am kind of shocked by is Sybil the one that wrote the note to
Edith
that wrote the note to the Turkish embassy? You know, in a sense, that's kind of passed over. I mean, she did this. She basically ruined or ruined the potential for her sister to make a good match. You know, if that were kind of widely exposed, and that's never adverted to. They don't really have a confrontation. The sisters almost exist in their own orbits. There's the sisters. I mean, in a kind of rather sexist way, and probably appropriate for the time, are just focused on getting a man. The only way that they interact is, you know, to sometimes kind of oppose one another. Elizabeth McGovern was on PBS, and she was saying that these three sisters are bored out of their minds.
Right, they have nothing else to do except for snipe at each other.
Yeah, snipe at each other and kind of, you know, sabotage each other's hopes. Now, is Sybil, does she have a love other than the farmer that she wasn't allowed to be with?
Or? Oh, you mean Edith.
Oh, Edith, excuse me.
We'll see. She has this older kind of gentleman caller who she's trying to reacquaint herself, who Mary sabotaged, how in the first season.
She dared her to sabotage it, and she did very well.
Yes.
Right.
So he's returned, but he's injured from the war. So we'll see if anything.
He seems a little old to be in the war, right?
He does.
Lord Grantham couldn't be in the war.
There are some questions that come up like this, but we prefer just to gloss over them. One other thing that I think is interesting is in terms of these people and how they approach work and sort of the dignity they find, especially the people living below stairs in these jobs that they do, which we may consider kind of unnecessary and superfluous.
Although I'd love a valet and a butler,
exactly,
frankly.
Right. But even Matthew, I mean, Julian Fellowes is smart. When he brings him on, he says, I don't need these people to do this work
right
for me. This is just unnecessary. But by saying that, you'd essentially put poor old Mosley out of a job. So.
Poor old Mosley, who doesn't do very much as far as I can see.
Nothing
against poor old Mosley.
But that's an interesting question. Like, especially, I would say, in the character of Carson and the real professionalism he brings to his job. He finds a great deal of satisfaction in it.
He does, and he also, I think, helps other people see the dignity in their work. You know, I mean, he's kind of the leader. I think he's probably the one who I'd love to have someone like Carson working for me. But even someone like Mrs. Patmore, when she accidentally puts salt into one of her dishes. Which, by the way, I talk about an overreaction when someone puts the food in their mouth. They basically, like, spit it out on the floor. I thought, well, it can't be that bad. It's just a little salty. When it's returned to her, she is mortified, and she cries, and she takes such pride in her work. I think even the ladies' maids and the valets take pride in their work. The question is, I thought a very telling moment was when Branson, the chauffeur, goes and basically asks for Sybil's hand from Lord Grantham. Lord Grantham gets upset and says, you know, you were carrying on behind my back all the while you were bowing and scraping. And I thought, well, gee, you know, does he really think that these people are doing work that's dignified? You know, which is interesting. Or does Lord Grantham really think that this is just kind of servile work himself?
Although he's the one who makes the case to Matthew when he wants to get rid of Mosley, saying, you know, where are you going to stop? If you don't use Mosley, or when you take over, you know, Downton Abbey, are you also going to get rid of, the other people you consider unnecessary? Mm-hmm. So these people, I mean, his approach, this noblesse oblige approach, is that these people need work. So you're right. He's playing it both ways a little bit there.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I have my butler and valet, I'll let you know how it goes.
I would just deal with a personal assistant. It would be enough for me.
Which, you know, funny enough, I mean, that's essentially what a lot of these people are. You know, the valet is the personal assistant, and
like,
certainly the lady's maid. But, you know, you do have to wonder why someone needs to put your necklace on for you.
Yes.
Now, I think one of the ironies is also, you know, in a democratic egalitarian society, you know, supposedly, as we live in, why this has become so popular, and whether or not it's popular just among the intelligentsia, you know,
right.
Because there really is this sense of why are people living like that, and why is it that the upstairs doesn't seem to mind too much, you know, the way the downstairs live, and really doesn't, they don't know a whole lot about them at the beginning. I mean, I think it gets more complicated, and you know, at the end, that part in the after the trial where they're all sitting around at a pub, once again, I don't know how realistic that is, but there is a kind of willful ignorance sometimes about what goes on downstairs, which I think is disturbing.
Right. No, I think you're right. Although at different points, there are people who are outsiders coming in, and I think the Turkish diplomat says this, why are you also concerned about the lives of these people? Like, in my country, these people are kind of just totally in the woodwork. But they do talk about the servants a lot, and they care about them. So,
well, maybe because they're so bored, too.
Exactly. Yeah. So it is kind of their own little soap opera watching what's going on downstairs.
And I think vice versa. I think for the people downstairs, they're fascinated by the people upstairs and all. You know, they keep track of, you know, what Lady Mary's doing. And, you know, for example, Carson is very upset, you know, when the thing with Matthew isn't going to work out. And, of course, you know, their livelihoods depend on them. And so they have more than just a passing interest in these people's love lives and their pursuits and their futures.
And Carson says explicitly that this is the only family I have is the Crawleys. And that's the case for a lot of these. That's an interesting piece of this. Somebody like Daisy, who has no parents, was abandoned. We're not sure what the backstory is there. But other people, too, who they're not allowed to marry. They're not allowed to really have kids. So it's...
Or Mrs. Hughes, who turns down a marriage proposal.
Oh, I forgot about
that.
Yeah,
who specifically says, you know, this is my family now and they need me. And these different kinds of loves.
Right, exactly. Now, maybe we can end by talking about the title. This is, you brought up an interesting idea. Where does the name Abby, where do you think that, what are the origins of that?
Well, I think, you know, it lies in the mind of Julian Fellowes. I'm sure he'll probably tell us at some point. But, you know, an abbey would have been a monastery at the time. And probably it's either, I'm wondering if that house was an abbey, which sort of kind of strains credulity, or more likely that the house is on the grounds of a former abbey. You know, a lot of these great houses, you know, this is the case in Brideshead too, you know, they have these ruins, you know, nearby, the ruins of the old abbeys, and, you know, very picturesque, and that was a very popular subject for the Romantic painters as well, the kind of tumble-down abbeys. But, you know, in the time of Henry VIII, these places would have been
right, the
dissolved.
Dissolution, right.
And so, you know, you and I were talking earlier about the possibility of whether or not this idea of the abbey and the dissolution, the destruction, you know, is somehow an image or a metaphor for what is going on at Downton Abbey in the house. You know, I think Eamon Duffy has written a lot about this period of time and how violent it was. And, I mean, you know, monks were killed and priests were killed and these abbeys were destroyed. So a word like dissolution is even kind of a sugarcoating. But I think that there is, whenever I see Downton Abbey, and funny enough, there was a parody of it, Saturday Night Live did a, as if Spike TV were doing Downton Abbey, and one of the first lines was, oh, this big family lives in a church. And, you know, it does have that kind of feel. So I wonder how much of that image or that Catholic sensibility or that part of history is going to be brought to the fore, or maybe it'll just, you know, kind of be a sort of motif, you know, underlying it.
Well, it's quite possible. We'll have to wait till next year. And, of course, those themes are there. We'll talk about them again maybe in 2013. Thank you very much, Father Jim.
My pleasure.